Toronto! I wonder if they can hear it on Long Island.
Great move. What a goal. Beauty. Austin Matthews.
Bless you, boys. What a game.
Welcome to episode 67 of the Maple Leafs Hot Stove podcast. I'm Nick Ashbourne, joined as always by Anthony Petrielli. We are coming to you after a bit of a nasty slide to the end of the Toronto Maple Leafs season. You got four consecutive losses, consistently giving up more than five or more goals in all of those games, and then, you know, ended with a whimper against the Tampa Bay Lightning in a game that was just bizarre to watch because it was about Austin Matthews trying to get his 70th goal and people trying to get it for him. And again, we don't have to position this as a selfish thing. There was a team component to that where people did want this to happen, but it was a very odd game to watch. And the previous three games, none of them would be considered impressive by any stretch of the imagination. Anthony, where do you come down on the significance of this finishing slide for the Maple Leafs?
I think we're both aligned that it very, very little, but I did think it was worthy of discussion because of, I guess, the chatter that's been out there regarding it. You know, people were critical of it. People were critical of, you know, the Nylander drive-by on the puck that was delayed. High stick that ended up as a breakaway goal, although that was a terrible line change on defense. That was really the crux of the issue there. So I do think it's worthy of some level of discussion, in particular, the way the Leafs have framed it, right? In the sense that if you saw Sheldon Keefe's comments after the game against Tampa, he hilariously said he couldn't tell you the score of any of the past four games. Which pretty much summed up him not caring. He pretty much made it clear that Nylander did not care, that he was focused on the playoffs. He admitted that he was pre-scouting the Bruins at intermission of that Tampa game. I mean, mentally, they clearly were not there. And, you know, if you look at the Florida game, for example, they're down 4-2 and just kind of rifling through their ice time. I don't want to do a full analysis of these games and how much they don't matter, but just to give people an idea. So the Leafs have the six penalties. Nylander didn't kill any of the penalties. Like, he was not on the ice on the penalty kill. We've seen him be a staple there now for like 4 or 5 months. And Matthews also, like, these guys were not featured as part of the penalty kill. Maybe I think Matthews had a few seconds towards the end of one, just as part of shifting to 5-on-5. But all that to say is by the time they started playing again in the third, you could tell that they were clearly out of the game because they basically didn't play in the second period because of the parade to the penalty box, which may or may not have been questionable officiating wise. So all that to say is if it was a real game and it mattered, one, they would have been on the penalty kill in general, but two, Keefe wouldn't have wanted to have lost them in the game, right? Like, he wouldn't have just said to Matthews and Nylander, like, you guys sit and watch the penalty kill for basically a period and then like magically hope to, you know, rekindle yourself in the game. Like, it obviously would not have been played like that. If you kind of go down the stretch of that third period, he was just rolling the lines. You could tell he was like, we play again tomorrow, this game doesn't matter, like, I'm not going to kill our guys. You know, he made light of the fact that they really only have 12 healthy forwards at the moment. They have no cap space to really call guys up and backfill that way for the time being. So it was essentially, I'm just going to roll the lines, I don't want to gas anyone, we play again tomorrow. We also don't care about that game, but, like, you know, you could see the breakdown of how they were playing things in terms of ice time and deployment. And then also the fact that the team was just passing to Matthews at an outrageous level. And, you know, they wouldn't have played that way if it was a meaningful game. So I don't know how you look at that and say, I'm worried about the way that they're playing down the stretch. But I will say that it is interesting to the level that Keefe kind of outlined it, because they're, you know, he's made this type of comment a number of times this season now, where it's basically like, you've seen us when we turn it on, like, we're good, I'm not worried kind of thing. And he said as much as well after the game against Tampa. And that's fair to some degree in the regular season. Their top guys have shown they could turn it on. I know we talked about it a lot earlier in the season The one that comes to mind is when they the first game against LA, they lost 4-1 and they were terrible. And then they went into LA and they were good. And that was kind of a litmus test game for me where I was kind of like, all right, let's see if, you know, they were bad the first time. Let's see if they just turn it on. And they did. And they were legitimately good. So I went, okay, well, I guess, you know, when they want to turn it on, they can. And they've kind of been that type of team with this core for probably 3+ years now. So fine that they think that, but, you know, they're not going to get the benefit of the doubt from people because of what they've done in the playoffs every year.
Yeah, it's easier to say we have another gear. We're going to turn it on when you've got a Stanley Cup in your back pocket. You know what I mean? When your team has a history of underperforming in the playoffs, it's going to be harder for people to feel confident that you can find your level when you need it. And also at the end of the season, you know, the power play when Marner came back, you could see the shape of it. And I think there's a level of confidence there that it's going to be fine. But the penalty kill, you know, was a problem all season long. You have new guys in it. Like, you, there are some components of the team that you would want to see, I don't know, in better form, for lack of a better term, heading into the playoffs. The goaltending as well, to be honest, like Samsonov was not as strong in the last few games of his season. But in particular, this, you know, the Lightning game, like, that's just not even a game. You're not playing your top two defensemen. You're playing your third goalie cold off like a 2-month break. And I'm not even saying Martin Jones was a big reason for what happened. You're chasing a milestone. The only line they rolled out last night that could be a playoff line was the Dewar, Kampf, Reeves fourth line, and that line performed really well, actually. And so again, to concern yourself too much with these games, I think, is doing a disservice. But, you know, the Maple Leafs draw in Boston, and this will be the focus of our episode today, is previewing that Boston series. But the Maple Leafs draw in Boston invites that doomerism mindset from the fan base, because they're already thinking about the nasty history. And so you have that in your mind, and then you watch them lose a few games in a row and have some shaky goaltending and all that. And I understand how people are getting to a negative place with it, but the playoffs are really a new season, and it starts on Saturday. And I'm not here predicting that the Maple Leafs are going to win the Stanley Cup, but I do think that it would do people a service to just kind of put the past in the past, or at least the immediate past, because clearly that is what Sheldon Keefe is doing. Before we get to,
they also won 5 of 6 to end last season, and the first playoff game was embarrassing. They got absolutely railroaded by Tampa. So, I mean, you could try to interpret these things that you're going to drive yourself crazy if you kind of go through, you know, all of the past records to end seasons and how much guys care and how much they don't, and all, like, you're going to talk yourself in circles. I think it's largely irrelevant unless they just come out and continue to play like that, which I don't think is going to be the case. I mean, if it's just a trend and it goes forward, you're going to say, yeah, I guess they shouldn't have mailed in those games because they just never got it back from there. I just think the odds of that are highly unlikely. So I don't think it's worth too much discussion.
In terms of the regular season as a whole, now it's finished, what the Leafs end up having is something that's sort of a little bit worse than last season all the way across the board. You know, when it comes to wins, points percentage, when it comes to power play, penalty kill, like, you could look at goal differential, kind of every individual basic stat you'd look at. The possession stuff is fairly similar, a little bit worse on expected goals. But you have, yeah, like a narrowly worse team than you had last year by regular season results. Now, part of the changes to this team was supposed to make it better in the playoffs. All of that remains to be seen. Anthony, when you look back on this regular season, what do you think you'll remember? What do you feel like you've learned from these 82? Because it's very tempting when you follow the Leafs to be like, the regular season doesn't matter. Let's see what happens in the playoffs. And that's where a lot of fans have been at for the last couple of years. But they play these 82 games for a reason, and there are important things to draw from them.
The biggest things that I probably will look back on is how much these players developed and how much, like, how real is it? And by these players, I don't, you know, even though I do think Nylander took a bit of a step this year, and obviously Matthews found another level in terms of his goal scoring. But ultimately, when I look at it, I think Did Pontus Holmberg cement himself as an NHL player this year? I would say yes. Is he a center? I'm not entirely sure, but I have liked him there. I think he's gotten stronger as the season has gone on, whereas last year he got weaker and then was out of the lineup. You know, there was a point last year where he looked like he was going to be on the playoff team, you know, earlier in the year. It was around, you know, January, December, but people were sitting there going, this guy's, he's a player, and he hit a wall. And this year he didn't. I also thought, like, again, it's hard to take too many things into this, but he obviously got rocked by Brandon Montour, but he knew that hit was coming and he took the hit to make the play and to get the puck out on the penalty kill. And I have a ton of respect for that. And if you've watched the Leafs in any at all over the past like 10 years, probably 20, actually, a lot of guys who wouldn't take a hit to get a puck out like that. And he knew he was going to get rocked, and he did get rocked and he did it. So I have a lot of time for players that do that, players that put themselves in harm's way, the sacrifice for the greater good type of thing. You know, he's not, you know, the top guys can justify not taking that hit in the final week. Pontus Holmberg cannot justify that. He's not that cemented into things where he could be like, yeah, I'm passing up taking a hit to make a play. And he did it and he took it. You know, it's toughness is not always dishing it out. It's taking it and continuing to chug along. So, you know, did he become a player this year? Simon Benoit obviously became a player this year. You know, your, you know, newfound favorite, Bobby McMahon, became a player this year. I think Matthew Nye's game, you know, it's not always a linear development, but I'm still as excited about the future of him as much as I was going into the year. I'm not entirely sure what he's going to give them this playoffs. And we've talked throughout the season about various struggles he's had, and it's been much cleaner since he's moved off of the top line because, you know, your game's not as exposed against better players when you're playing down the lineup. And you can clearly see the way that he's been able to drive things a little bit better against weaker players, which is exciting. So, you know, I think his game came along. I think Nick Robertson gave a lot of people things to think about that they otherwise might not have. You know, I think a lot of people were down on him. And I remember going into the season writing that, like, I think this guy's easily a 20 goal scorer if you gave him the reps. And at that point, he had like 3 goals in like 30 games or something in the league. And I saw a lot of comments like, how could you possibly say that? You know, he hasn't scored at all in the league. But it was evident looking at his shot and his nose for the net that he could clearly score. He just needed some ice time and opportunity. And if he played all season and was, you know, regularly featured on the second power play unit, I think 20 goals would have been very easy. Not very easy, but I think he would have accomplished it comfortably. So all of these guys kind of coming along is probably the main thing I'll take away once we kind of look back to things in the summer. Now, how much that helps from this playoff specifically, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that what you lay out there with kind of the middle six and depth forwards, that's been a big talking point for us over the weeks. And I think that's absolutely right in terms of what we've learned about the Maple Leafs, because that's been arguably the biggest development. As well as some of the things on the D, like you mentioned, Benoit. I think Jake McCabe, obviously he's a proven veteran defenseman, but based on what he had shown the previous season since coming to the Leafs, him settling in at the level he did, and I think the season he had was underrated. Like, he was really good.
He was a legitimate number three defenseman. Like, I think people are downplaying that. Like, the definition of a third defenseman to me is you're in the top four and you drive your pairing. And he drove his pairing with a player who's much worse. Like, I love Simon Benoit, but he's much worse. And he drove that pairing to good results.
On his offside as well.
Like, that is the definition of a third defenseman.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the season, the Leafs have had the Riley pairing and the McCabe pairing, regardless yes. of who has been cycling through that. But that has been, like, what they can count on. The one thing bigger picture, and this is, I don't know if it's, like, a me thing exclusively, but is this season reminded me a little bit to be cautious and humble with your early reads, right? Because Samsonov out of the gate, like, there was a point where he looked like totally cooked mentally. You know what I mean? It looked like he was just not able to hold up under the pressure of this. Even though he was great last season, he just came out and he looked wrong. He looked like he did not have it. And I think, you know, I was not alone in thinking, okay, this is just not his year or needs a change of scenery or whatever, and it's going to be Wohl. And, you know, that hasn't been the case. He's bounced back in admirable fashion. And Ryan Reeves, too. And like, it's not like Reeves has been an incredible player or whatever. And I think that you could probably still do better with that money. That whole role is up for debate. But watching him at the beginning of the season, I thought, okay, this is not a functional NHL player. And the Leafs are destroying their fourth line by putting him out there and making, you know, the benefits of camp brings moot because of what this guy's doing on the wing. And then he had his time away and he came back. And then he started doing, you know, again, not incredible things, great one-timer in the season finale, but not groundbreaking things on the ice, but at the same time became a valuable forechecker and part of a line that was able to take some defensive assignments. And so I think that's one thing I'll bring into next year is like, remember 15, 20 games into a season, things are going to change. And I think everyone is aware of that, but in the moment, it's very easy to get caught up in like, this guy's bad, this guy's busted, it's over for this. Or the flip side, this guy's like incredible. A little bit of more patience is warranted than sometimes we give it.
So I'm always fond of saying there's multiple parts of a season, right? And so I think a couple of things can be true within that. Like players can look terrible. It's a real thing. But then the game changes as the season goes along and as veterans get their legs and as the game tighten up and teams kind of hit their actual stride and all of these things. So there's the first part of the season, which is the beginning until American Thanksgiving. And that is largely there's, you know, it's shiny new toy syndrome. Everybody's bright eyed and bushy tailed. And you have a bunch of like 19-year-olds playing in the league that teams are trying to give young players a shot. They want to see what guys look like. Fraser Minton is in the lineup. You know, it's that's not real hockey. Like you go back and you look at like the Anaheim Ducks were on a heater to start the year. It's that kind of, I don't want to say nonsense, but it's the easiest part to get fooled. It's just not particularly tight checking defensive. It is not, it's not at the level it needs to be. And then you get into the middle part of the season, which obviously after American Thanksgiving till roughly the All-Star break is when like, that's like the time to start like cementing yourself in the standings. I think that's when teams kind of go, okay, it's time. We have to like settle in. And then you're approaching that time of the trade deadline where I think teams are starting to come to reality with like where they kind of are in the situation and like what they need to do to potentially get out of the situation or to continue to push forward. Or it's that time of year where all the bad teams are kind of like falling off going like, yeah, we're terrible. We know it. Like it is what it is. And then you get after the trade deadline, which is like the down the stretch play here. And I think you saw it for probably like a month. This past week, other than the games to end the final Eastern Conference playoff spot, has largely been a joke from all the top teams. Like you could tell they're all like, we don't care. We just want to get healthy to the playoffs, et cetera, et cetera. But everyone else from like the trade deadline up until like that past week was like really good hockey. Like I really, really liked the hockey. You could see the intensity was up. Like the first time the Leafs played Florida, like that game had a lot to it, right? Like the next game, even against Tampa, like you kind of go through those games and you go, okay, like these are guys like gearing up. Like this is the big boys picking it up saying like, it's almost time. And then you get into playoffs, which is a whole brand new season altogether. Like you can't, like there is nothing in the regular season that is even remotely comparable to playoff hockey. Like, I'm sorry. Like you see it all the time. It's like the worst thing I think that happens. On like TV and game broadcasts, they'll go to a game. It was like the Red Wings game against the Habs. And I'm, you know, watching and they're like playoff like atmosphere. I'm like, this is not playoffs. Like this, like the first of all, the Habs are in this game. So like, let's call that what that, like you cannot have a playoff like game when the Montreal Canadiens are their current rendition anyway, is in it. Like that's just not real. And it's not playoff intensity. Like, I'm sorry, it's not. Like, it's still a step below what playoff hockey is. And like anyone who's kind of been through the gauntlet, like player-wise, will tell you. Like they, you know, they don't want to say it, but like it's not like what playoffs is. Playoffs is an entirely different animal. And now we're at it. But like you look at the past week or even the past two games, it's like Bertuzzi was not good, right? Like the goal that he gave up against Tampa with like the back drop pass.
Oh,
like,
yeah, that was wild.
Domi is, or sorry, Bertuzzi is like, he cannot play like shinny type hockey, right? Which is why he looked terrible at the start of the season when it's like jersey flapping in the wind type of year or type of time, and like wide open hockey and like not tight checking. And then it, like, he's not good in those games where the team's kind of like, we don't care. Like, it's about like moving the puck and things of this nature. But then like any game that's been against a top tight checking, grind it out, he's been excellent. He's been excellent, like pretty much all of them. So you kind of have to break it down and just be aware of the ebbs and flows of what a season is.
And I think we want to focus this episode on what you guys are here to listen to, which is a preview of a series with the Boston Bruins. I'm going to throw a few of the basic numbers out there. Then we're going to get into what makes the Bruins a scary opponent, which I think if you're listening, you probably have some ideas about that. And also what makes the Bruins potentially a vulnerable and a beatable opponent. And before, we don't have to get to that section yet, but I do think that there's this air of invulnerability about the Bruins in the context of the Maple Leafs in the playoffs because of recent history. And I think both of us are of the opinion that this is not an unbeatable juggernaut by any stretch of the imagination, but we will get there. So the Maple Leafs went 0-2-2 against the Bruins. They won the shot battle 137-129, but lost the goal battle 14-7. At 5-on-5, they outshot Boston 105-91, but they were outscored 10-5. The expected goals were 9.82 to 7.81 for Boston, so that's 44.3% for the Maple Leafs. That's an ugly number, obviously. And on special teams, the Bruins went 3-for-10 on their power play. Toronto went 1-for-11 on their power play. Those numbers sort of conform to, at least in my view, our memories and our understanding of what playing Boston is like. Like, Boston often gives up precisely what it wants to give up and does a good job of preventing the highest danger opportunities. So you can outshoot Boston. You can, depending on how they're counting the chances, you can potentially outchance Boston, but it is very difficult to get the very best chances in a game against the Bruins. And when you do, you have to execute. And I think you were tweeting on Justin Bourne's piece on it, where he pointed out that the Leafs had one of their lowest high danger shooting percentages of the season against the Bruins. And that simply can't be the case, because you do not potentially get as many of these opportunities against Boston as you do against other teams. And you have to bury them. Easier said than done.
And they have a great goalie.
Talking about their goaltending, right? But that's the worry. So let's start here with what makes Boston scary. And I know that, again, if you're listening and you're a relatively long-time Leafs fans, you have no issue conjuring things that make the Bruins scary, but we can get a little bit more specific. Anthony, where do you want to start with what makes the Bruins a difficult opponent?
Well, I think there is a mental hurdle. I do think that is very real. You know, it's the Paul McFarland, the quote, right? The infamous, they have demons in their heads. They have demons under their beds. They have demons everywhere. In the Amazon Prime series, that does come to mind. And it'll be interesting to see how Sheldon Keefe kind of navigates all of this, because he wasn't the coach when the Leafs lost to the Bruins twice. But the core was all there. Tavares wasn't there for the first year. He was there for the second year. But obviously, Riley, Matthews, Marner, and Nylander were there. And we'll have bad memories of going into Boston and losing Game 7 twice, for that matter. So I do think that's a real thing. I do think they're going to have to overcome it. I do think that there is something very real to overcoming your fears or your demons or whatever you want to call it on the way to achieving ultimate success. Like, I think that's just a natural part of life, no matter what kind of field you're in. In this case, it's hockey. In this case, it's the Bruins. Like, you have to be honest about that. Like, you can't just ignore the fact that they have some level of mental edge over the Leafs, and the Leafs are just going to have to get over it. I think ignoring it entirely is foolish. I think owning it and pushing through it is the best way to go about it. I've been reading some Boston media clips and listening to a few different things. I always like to kind of go through the other team. Sometimes if I'm writing an article even, or looking back on the past week, one thing I try to do is pull up some articles for whatever the other team has written, or, you know, listen to what their coach said, because sometimes we just get too gravitated and focusing on the Leafs and you miss the forest for the trees. And sometimes when you just look at the other team and go, ah, okay, this is what they were thinking, and it grounds you a little bit and it helps you see the other side. But it was really striking to me how very confident the Bruins media was. That was basically, you know, the Bruins are not upset about this. This is best case scenario that they got the Leafs. This is a good matchup for them. They should feel great about it. And that should all be bulletin board material for the Leafs, as far as I'm concerned. And you could say it's not coming from the players, and that's fine. But as we just saw in Florida this week, they're still chanting, "We want Florida." And it wasn't the Leaf players that came out after beating Tampa and said, "Oh, like we want, like we're all Panthers fans tomorrow." They didn't say shit. It was the fans, and their fans and their players really bought into that. And fair enough, I would too if I was them. But to me, the Leafs should really be buying into that. The Bruins were brutal the last two games against two pretty substandard teams. Okay, Washington was playing for their lives, and Ottawa was their last game with Jacques Martin as coach. So I expected, you know, both would be up for it. But the Bruins were uncharacteristically poor for a team that largely dressed their guys. So all that to say is, I do think that there's a mental way for them to flip that. I think if Sheldon Keefe is kind of dismissive of that whole thing, I think it's a poor approach. But if we're talking first initial piece, it's that mental hurdle. And then to everything that you just said about the defense, as you were kind of going through that, I hadn't really thought about this until just listening to you now, is it actually reminds me a lot of the Montreal series in 2021. The Habs had an excellent goalie. They had a really good defense that made it hard for the Leafs to get to the inside and score. There's not a lot of firepower on the team, you know, save for a few guys. Pasternak is obviously better than anybody the Habs had, but the general point of not a lot of firepower, big defense that will make it tough for you to get inside, and then the few times that you do, you have to go up against an excellent goalie. I'm not saying they're perfect like-for-like comparisons, but I see a lot of similarities in that. And obviously, we know how that series ended for the Leafs.
Yeah, and beyond just the defense and pass down, because those are the things that are on the first things you think of, is like, how do you shut down Pasternak? The Maple Leafs have not really been able to do it this season in their games against him. He's looked incredibly dangerous. He's looked like the most dangerous forward on the ice.
He's been the best player all four games, and that's a big problem.
So that's number one. And then you have the combination of the solid defense and the goaltenders. It's interesting, actually, just today as we're recording, the Bruins put out their lines, and they had Lindholm and McAvoy on the same pair, on the first pair, which is an unbelievable pair. I think I probably would spread them out if it were me. But they, if you look at the defense, the third pair is maybe not as great, but also whose is. Like, it's one of those things, we've talked about this before. Like, you can poke apart any team's bottom six. You can poke apart any team's third pair. The other component of it beyond that defensive war in Pasternak is the special teams. And again, this has been an issue for the Maple Leafs in the playoffs, but Boston has an above average power play, 22.2%, and a well above average penalty kill. Although, again, you'd expect that with that level of goaltending, but still 82.5%, which is seventh in the league. That has got to be an enormous component of this series, because if the Maple Leafs lose the special teams battle by a notable margin, and, you know, they're coming into playoffs with one of the worst penalty kills in the league statistically, and the players on that have changed, and some of the philosophies have changed, that number may not fully reflect where they're at this exact moment. But that's another thing that makes Boston scary to me. It's like, they're above average on both special teams. The Leafs have not proven they're a group that can wipe out a solid power play, even if maybe that's within their grasp. They've not proven that yet. And they head in facing a very high level penalty kill at a time when their power play is just finding its footing again after Marner returned.
Yeah, the special teams is the other big part of it. Obviously, it would be very, very difficult for the Leafs to outplay special team struggles on both sides. You could maybe get away with your penalty kill being meh if your power play also produces, but again, their power play will have to produce in order for that to actually be a thing. So their power play has not been good against Boston. Boston clearly has a number on their penalty kill at the moment. So I think that is, and when I say that, I mean, when I go back and watch the games, and I remember even just watching it live, thinking to myself, they're jumping every route. Their pre-scout on the Leafs power play was excellent. They knew where they wanted the puck to go. They blocked every proper lane. You know, if the puck went down low to Marner, they knew where Marner was passing and where he didn't want to pass to, and they blocked the right lane every time. You know, I don't think the Leafs power play is overly predictable. I know people get into those modes where they think that it is, but you have to look around the league. Like, this is a perennial top 10 power play unit. These guys aren't bums on the power play by any means. So, and very few teams have figured them out, but Boston very much so had them figured out. And that was an issue. It's like, you go back and look at the power play against them, it was really bad. That, like, one power play goal that they could really note was essentially off a stretch pass breakout to Marner, and he went down and scored off the rush. Like, it wasn't an in zone power play setup, it was an off the rush power play goal, which is very rare for the Leafs too. So, like, that is a big piece of it. And then the second part is the penalty kill of it, and Pastrnak in particular has really lit them up. I think they've let him get way too comfortable. He's had way too much time and space to make decisions. I'm very curious how the Leafs attack him. I'm also very curious to that end. I mean, this would have applied regardless whether they played Florida or Boston, because both have good power plays. What that does to Connor Dewar's spot in the lineup, because he is a good penalty killer for them, and they've been much better with him in the lineup on the penalty kill than without. And is that enough to be in the playoff lineup? Because I know that they have a ton of good forwards. I get that. They're probably 15 deep. Like, this is about as deep a team as we've seen them go in with. I'm not saying that the overall output of it is maybe, you know, like, they don't have another Ryan O'Reilly type player kind of thing, but in terms of overall depth, there, you know, other than an injury to a top guy, you'd look at any of the other injuries and go, okay, they can reasonably swap this guy in or that guy in or whatever the case is, and like, good players are going to be sitting. But if Dewar adds something to the penalty kill to help negate Boston there, I think the Leafs should feel reasonably good about a 5-on-5 playoff series against Boston, goaltending notwithstanding, because that, you know, Samsonov is obviously the biggest wild card of all of the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the Dewar should be in the lineup because special teams are going to be such a big part of it, because, as you said, he is proven to be one of their better guys there. He also, if he plays on that first unit, he prevents Marner from being on that unit, which can ease some of Marner's workload, which in the playoffs we've seen get to like truly bizarre levels. And I'm not saying that, you know, Marner is, you know, lacks endurance. Yeah. Some euphemisms there. I'm not saying like Marner lacks endurance or whatever, then that he's incapable of doing these things. But at the same time, there's a reason other teams don't ask their first line wingers to play all the minutes that Marner has soaked up at times during the playoffs. And so having Dewar there on his own merit, but also to help that, I think would be useful. There's still some ambiguity with the Maple Leafs forwards and who's healthy and who's going to be able to play. And it's not really for us at this point as we record to be able to get into the minutiae of that, but I'm sure that's something that we'll discuss as the series goes on, who they rotate in and who's available.
I do think as part of it though, so playoffs is all about matchups, right? Anyone will tell you within the league, the difference from the regular season, the playoffs, is in the regular season, you're focused on yourself. By and large, you're spending time on yourself, right? When teams are preparing game by game, it's about what we can do. We control what we can control. Here's where we need to make improvements or whatever the case is. It's about you, by and large, with a few extra wrinkles, depending on whatever unique team you might be playing or unique individual or this, that, whatever. Hey, this team traps in the neutral zone. This team is aggressive with two guys. But by and large, you're focusing on yourself. The difference in the playoffs is you focus a lot more on your opponent and what they're about and their tendencies, like the minutiae of that, of the pre-scouting and forcing certain situations and all of those domino effects is a lot more prevalent. So I think when we look at the 5-on-5 matchup, here's what we know is going to happen. The Bruins are going to try to match up Charlie Coyle, Brad Marchand, and Jake DeBrusque against the Matthews line. Even with the Leafs spread out attack, there's just no chance that they're not putting Coyle, Marchand, and DeBrusque against Auston Matthews. It would be crazy otherwise. The way the Leafs are running it is that in turn, and Boston too, is in turn, John Tavares and Mitch Marner and whoever's on their wing, probably hopefully Bobby McMahon, potentially Kyle Yarncroc, and this is also why I can't see it being Matthew Nyes, will go up against the David Pastrnak line with Danton Heinonen and Pavel Zacha. So that leaves potentially a third situation where William Nylander is on the third line with Pontus Holmberg, and then take your pick of player. Is it Kalle Yarncroc? Is it Nick Robertson? Is it Matthew Nyes? I don't know. Going up against a third line that's basically Geeky, Lacko, and Trent Bedrick. And a big crux of the series is going to be Nylander is going to have to make them pay. And so it's particularly interesting, as you just noted, that Hampus Lindholm is paired with Charlie McAvoy. Because I imagine from Boston's side, they're going eggs in one basket. Lindholm and McAvoy are going to take the Matthews matchup, and we shut him down, we win this series. But if Nylander is absolutely tilting that third matchup, how can Boston justify keeping those two guys together? I don't see it. They're going to have to split them up, right? They're their two best defensemen. There's just no planet in which they could sit there and say, yeah, these guys are going to net out Matthews, who I still think might score a goal or two. And we're just going to watch Nylander absolutely carve up Andrew Peak and Kevin Shattenkirk on his offside. I just don't see that. So when we talk, like, this is playoffs, like, this is matchups. You have to win your matchup. First and foremost, the lead, like, that Tavares line cannot get absolutely tilted by Pastrnak. Like, they cannot get eaten alive. And the Leafs are going to go defense by committee. I don't look at a single pairing that the Leafs have and go, yeah, that's for sure the matchup pairing. Maybe Benoit McCabe.
I was just saying, like, Benoit McCabe is the closest they have to that.
Now, and that's Benoit playing against Pastrnak too.
Yeah.
Like, that's that side of the ice. So that to me is the argument for potentially putting Kalle Yarncroc there. He's not some incredible defensive winger, but he's an honest, like, he's a good pro. He will not give up cheap things to Pastrnak. He will make him work for it. He will make it hard. He will be in every right lane. His stick will be in every right spot. He will be diligent. He won't get caught cheating for offense. Like, he'll be difficult. He will be, I don't want to say a problem, but he won't be easy. To me, like, you look at a player like Matthew Nyes, again, like, I'm not trying to pick on him. I imagine he's a little younger. He's going to push for offense at times. He's going to get a little bit loose in coverage at times, you know, up and down his own wall, getting pucks out of his own zone. That's what you get with younger players. So that is really the gist of how this matchup's going to go. It's like, if Matthews can break the Coyle, Marchand, DeBrusque line, Boston is in real trouble. Like, Boston, I don't know if they can recover from that. But then also, if Nylander can tilt that Trent Frederick third line, instead of like last time when they were in Boston, right? I'm sure everyone remembers, gave the puck away at the blue line. It was Trent Frederick going down on breakaway scoring. Like, that, like, is the exact opposite. Like, if they're losing that third line matchup to Geeky and Frederick, and Geeky also scored that game, I mean, it'll be very, very hard for the Leafs to outplay that. So, and their fourth line is not, like, neither fourth line is an offensive fourth line. Like, both fourth lines are going to be just grinders and tone setters and physicality, which I think is why you'll see Reeves in at least for the first game before things might settle down elsewhere. But that's the chess match right now going into it to me. So I'm actually surprised to see Boston starting with Lindholm, McAvoy together. I'll leave it for that, but swing back to you because I have some thoughts on Jim Montgomery as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, this is what they're practicing. It's not a guarantee that's the way it's going to be. The Leafs like I said, it's just so hard to predict. The Yarncroke thing makes a lot of sense with Tavares and Nylander, and Marner in terms of that goal, that line having a more defensive goal. We haven't seen a ton of that line this season, but we have seen it in the past. And again, it's not, you know, it can't be Knies because we've seen actually quite a bit of Knies, Tavares, and whether it's Nylander or Marner this season, and it's generally just not gone well. What I do want to focus kind of the second half-ish of this episode on is what makes Boston vulnerable. Because, again, I just think that there's this notion in a lot of Leafs fans' heads that this team is on a different level than the Leafs and there's a inevitable loss here. And that's, you know, that's not how I feel. I know we talked before we recorded. That's not how you feel. Like, Boston had 47 wins compared to the Leafs having 46. Boston had a goal differential 40 plus 43 compared to plus 40 for the Maple Leafs. Like, these teams, there's the, you know, the loser points distort the standings. And I'm not saying the Leafs had a better regular season than Boston because they didn't, but they weren't in two totally different categories by any stretch of the imagination. And when I think about the first thing that makes Boston potentially vulnerable to the Leafs, I think about, and you kind of got into it a little bit with how the lines match up, but I think about the lack of firepower behind Pastrnak. Like, Pastrnak is obviously one of the most deadly offensive forces in the NHL, and the Leafs don't have an obvious answer to him, and he is a problem in every way, shape, or form. But it's worth remembering that Marchand was second on this team with 67 points. Like, they're the next, Marchand is a lot older at this point, and he's going to have an effect on the series that goes beyond what he simply scores and his offensive production. But there is not wave after wave of dangerous offensive players with Boston. There is wave after wave of competence. And there's a lot of times when competent players make the right plays, but don't ultimately produce. And for me, you could envision a world where Boston is just too reliant. And it's funny saying this because that's been story with the Leafs. So the Leafs are too reliant on this couple of players, but you could envision a world where Pastrnak goes cold for whatever reason, or gets nicked up, or the Leafs find a better answer for him than anticipated. Their offense is so reliant on him and what he does. And in terms of raw firepower, like, for me, there's not much question that Boston's in a deficit to the Leafs here.
Yeah, and I think it actually extends beyond that. I mean, even the competence, I think, is worth debating. They were 24th in 5-on-5 Corsi this year. Like, they did, they actively got outplayed. They were second in the league in PDO. You know, they're largely led by their goaltending being incredible. So you kind of put those things together and go, all right, well, let's look at this. They get outplayed. They rely a lot on goaltending. They don't score particularly well, right? They're, you know, you look at it, their general, like, goal scoring finishing is essentially middle of the pack of the league in terms of 5-on-5 shot attempts for, like, Corsi for, they're 25th. Like, they do not tilt play. They do not control play by and large. They don't have a ton of good finishers. Essentially, what they have is really good goaltending, a really stout defense, and they're able to counterattack you based on a few guys, right? I was at the Leafs-Bruins game when Matthew scored with like 4 seconds left, and then Nylander fell in overtime and Marchand scored, because of course he did, and celebrated the way that he did. And I, watching the game live in particular, when you kind of get, you know, a little bit of the higher overall view of the game, I just sat there and went, the Leafs are entirely dictating this game. And all Boston did is sit back and just wait out mistakes, right? And we've talked about it from a matchup standpoint of how the Leafs need to break it. I think the second part is, and we've talked about this so much this year, is they really need to negate giving things away for free. That's honestly going to be their, like, the guys need to score and they need to break the Bruins structure in terms of how they want things to go from a formatting lineup point. Like, they have to have Jim Montgomery spinning going, I can't handle these matchups with my guys. And then the second part is they need to just not make it easy on Boston, right? We talked about the Nylander Frederick goal. Like, if you go through most of Boston's goals this year, it's just brutal Leaf giveaways in the neutral zone, weak up the wall. You know, just it's not the Bruins did something exceptional to score. It's the Leafs did something really bad to make it easy on the Bruins. And it, like, you don't need things to be necessarily beautiful, but if you just chip pucks out, you make the Bruins actually go through your five-man unit to score. You don't give them anything for free. You don't get overly aggressive pushing for offense, which I think is a big problem for them, especially at home. We've talked about that a number of times over the past few months, right? Like, they almost push for offense to their detriment, to the point where teams just then counterattack the other way, right? We saw it against Jersey last week too, right? Where, you know, Morgan Riley pinches, Devils go down on a 2-on-1. It's like that kind of show all the time from these guys. And if they're able to kind of negate that, giving away things for free and just make the Bruins work for it, they've shown that they can't do that this year.
To Boston's credit, I think that they force people to do that because people get frustrated trying to score on this strong defensive structure and this excellent goaltending. And so they bring their opponents to a place where they feel like they have to get more aggressive than they would normally get, and that results in more counter-attacking opportunities. So I do think the Bruins deserve some credit where credit's due there, because also, if you look at the numbers...
They're a veteran team. They're a well-coached veteran team.
Like, things like Corsi will say that they're one of the worst ones in the league, but then if you look at expected goals or high-danger chances, they're slight, not incredible, but they're, like, above 50%, because, again, it's about quantity versus quality with them a little bit. And but you're right, if the Leafs are able to, I don't know, go against their worst nature and stop being overly ambitious, like, you can have success in preventing Boston from generating offense, because when they have to generate offense from scratch on account of only their own skill level, that's going to be difficult for them to do at times. And that kind of brings me to the second thing, which, again, this is pretty clear, but there's an advantage at center here. Like, the Leafs are supposed to have an advantage against at center against a lot of teams, the way they're designed with Tavares and Matthews at the top. And, you know, we can debate where Holmberg is as a third center and whether Kamp is kind of effectively a third center based on the way they're going to use him. But the reality is that Boston's rolling out Zacha, Coyle, and Geeky as their top three. And I know Coyle in particular has had a really strong season and is a two-way center that might be a little bit underrated because people remember what he did earlier in his career. But at the end of the day, like, there's not a lot of series you're going to find around the NHL where one team has that theoretical level of advantage down the middle of the ice and is the big underdog. Like, normally, the team that has the big, powerful, productive centers that you can trust, the stars at that position, are the teams that are really, really good and are the teams that are considered to be the favorites in whatever series they're in. And, you know, this has been a problem for the Leafs in, you know, if you go back an era, right, you go to the Phil Kessel, Dion Phaneuf era, it kept being like, oh, this team doesn't match up with good teams down the middle of the ice. And you can make the argument that Boston doesn't match up with Toronto down the middle of the ice.
There's no argument. That's just the reality. I mean, the Leafs have a superstar at center and the Bruins don't have anything close to that. So, you know, there's no argument. That's just the truth. I mean, it would be hilarious for anyone to argue otherwise. I don't even think Bruins fans would argue it. What they would argue is their defense is way better and their goalie is way better. Now, I'm not saying their goalie is not way better, but I will say two things. One, Samsonov was excellent last year in the playoffs. Like, he was incredible. We've talked about this a million times. He was the number one reason far and away that they beat the Tampa Bay Lightning last year. He actively outplayed Andrei Vasilevsky. Without Samsonov putting in the performance that he did, the Leafs lose in the first round instead of the second. So you got an extra week and a half because of Ilya Samsonov, and he was hurt for that Panthers series. And that was also a big reason. Not that Wall was bad, but losing your starting goalie is a big deal. And the Leafs did that. So I'm Samsonov again is I. Look, I'm not going to sit here and tell anyone that he's going to be excellent in the playoffs. That would be a lie to everyone's face. I'm also not going to sit here and say I'm not hopeful that he is a guy in the playoffs. Like, I think he can. I think he can. I think he is. I think he's been, by and large, excellent in the second half of the season. I am, like a fool, cautiously optimistic that he can be good again. Now, the second part to that is And this will just kind of evolve into Jim Montgomery in general. The Bruins did not get good goaltending last year in the playoffs. Now, by and large, that's because Linus Ullmark was playing hurt. That was an insane decision. But one of the things that happens with the Bruins is they have a really good tandem. And that's great for them, for especially an 82-game regular season. You definitely need two goalies. Now, come playoff time, you don't tandem things. Swayman played 44 times and Ullmark played 40. So there must have been a pull in there too, a couple pulls. But they split it down the middle, right? You do not get to do that in the playoffs. There is one guy. And if you are alternating back and forth, there is very much an opportunity for the Leafs. Like, it takes basically one game for people to start questioning why the other guy is not in net. And the Leafs could definitely play that side of the coin. That's why game one is particularly important to me, because I imagine Jeremy Swayman starts it, and he's been excellent against the Leafs this year. It would be absolutely wild to me if Jeremy Swayman does not start the series. But if the Leafs come out and they rip four or five past him, there will be questions for Jim. And last year, he took a lot of heat for how he handled a number of things in the playoffs. And again, fans are very focused on the Leafs here. I don't think that they go out and have a proper understanding of other things that happen in the league. It's, you know, in game six, he sat Matt Grizzlick and he put Connor Clifton in, who was an absolute mess. Like, he was on for like four goals against. He actively gifted the Panthers three. Like, the Bruins should have ended the series in six. You go back and watch it, like, you're just going to be insanely confused as to how Connor Clifton was in the lineup, how he was playing so much, and how much of a liability he was. Montgomery took a ton of heat for that. How he handled playing an injured Linus Ullmark, who was not playing well. How he just randomly switched to Jeremy Swayman for game seven, cold turkey. And Swayman was good, but he let in a terrible first goal that, again, that could have swung things. He took a lot of heat for not pairing up Pastrnak with Bergeron and Marchand. Basically did it in overtime. Pastrnak beat Bob, but hit like the knob of his stick. And then obviously we know what happened after that. Like, Jim Montgomery took a lot of heat, rightfully so. And he owned it. Like, this is not just high stakes for Sheldon Keefe here. Like, this is really high stakes for Jim Montgomery, too. They've had two excellent seasons under him, but you lose to the Panthers after having the greatest regular season in history and blowing a 3-1 lead, and then you lose to the Toronto Maple Leafs, which we know how they feel about them there. That seat is going to get particularly spicy. Like, this is not just... this is not playing John Cooper, who's very comfortable and a cup champion. This is also playing a guy who has very much a lot to prove. Like, Sheldon is not alone in this one. And that first game to me is, you know, in Boston, again, like, they're going to start one. You have a chance to really swing things the other way and have the Bruins start asking questions about what they're doing in that and who their guy is. Like, starting on the road in this one is very beneficial, because you could lose the first two and be like, we haven't played a home game yet. But the Bruins will not be in that boat. Like, they really do have to take advantage of this. Like, I hope they go into it a little bit like loose, nothing to lose. These guys wanted us, chip on our shoulder. Like, I think there's a lot there for them to build off of.
Yeah. And in terms of the home road aspect of it, we think of the Bruins as having this incredible home ice advantage, and they did during their record-breaking season last year. But if you look at it this season, their record at home is exactly the same as the Maple Leafs' record on the road. So when you're looking at that, you're saying, okay, there isn't a fundamental advantage here, especially when there is not a big travel component either. Like, and you don't really get that early in the playoffs anyway, but it's a very easy trip to make. And it should be a place they're relatively comfortable playing. You know,
it's there's game six and seven. Like, you don't want to play game seven in Boston if you can avoid it. And if you have a chance to wrap up in game six in Toronto, which is what they did have in 2019, and they messed that up. Like, that's where home ice comes into play.
For sure. And on the goaltending side of it, the thing about goaltending is that it's so
made up position, just made up, just entirely made up.
It's entirely made up. No, but it's so volatile in a short period of time, right? Like, over the course of 82 games, when you have a better goaltender, you're going to get better results. And that's going to play a big role in the success you have in the season. But over six or seven games, anyone can be a stud and anyone can be a bum. And now the Bruins do have the two guys, right? So if one guy falters, they can turn to the next guy. And that's the, like you laid out the disadvantage. That's the advantage. If one of the guys comes out and he doesn't have it for whatever reason, they've got an excellent plan B. And so that's something to be concerned about. But when you're talking about goaltending, a goaltending advantage, again, maybe outside of the truest superstars in the, at that position. And I'm not sure that I would say either the Boston guys qualify, even though their results are obviously really good, but they've both been sort of tandem goaltenders. And, you know, Ullmark was obviously had amazing results last year, not quite the same this season. I don't think you can go into this series and say, you know, the Bruins are a lock to win the series because they can count on their goaltending advantage. In most, if you run the simulation a million times, in most of them, I guess the Bruins get better goaltending than the Leafs in this series, but I don't think it's a foregone conclusion the way some people are thinking of it.
Yeah, I've been very, again, I'm very torn on the Leafs goaltending situation. I see everything out there statistically about it. I'm not blind. I mean, but I also am just mindful of the fact that like their goaltending had a number of twists and turns this year that
sure did.
I don't really think the numbers are particularly indicative of the goaltending. Like, I don't think Samsonov is an 890 goalie, which is what he ends the season with. Like, he's 890. I think he is a much better goalie than that. And I think he was for a solid couple of months here down the stretch. Obviously, the past week hurts like everybody's numbers, but by and large, when the games mattered and things dialed in, he was very good. And I don't know. So the goaltending is one thing that I just constantly look at. Again, not a goalie guy. Other than the obvious things, you know, when a guy's swimming, you know, when a guy's deep in his net, you know, when a guy's fragile, you know, the very high level things. But I just look at it and go, I think that people are dismissive of it. I think people are underrating it almost a little bit. You know, if Samsonov was bad in the playoffs last year, don't get me wrong, I'd be sitting here going, I'm scared about what's happening. And I don't think Wohl has done anything to give them any sort of confidence of late. You know, even that Brandon Montour goal against Florida, you know, it was like a center net slap shot. It's high, but it's the NHL. It's high slap shot, middle of the net. That's got to be a save. So I don't know. I look at it and go, if you want to give yourself a massive advantage here, go for it. But I'm not entirely sold. I think Samsonov can go save for save. He did it against the absolute best last year. You know, I think there's more to it than that. I think he can be a guy. Again, maybe it's just blind faith. I look at it and just go, I don't know. I don't know if it's being framed the right way. I think the early season struggles in particular are kind of tilting the numbers in a lopsided fashion. I think it would be, you know, at the end of the day, he was an 890 goalie this year. It would be hard to convince me that he's an 890 quality type goaltender. Like, you couldn't convince me that Joseph Wohl is better.
Based on what we saw last season, based on, like, you can take a stretch, for instance, if you throw out the last two games, which have been kind of team level garbage, weird lineup in, lineup out. If you throw out the last two games, Samsonov, between when he came back from going on waivers, his little mental break, whatever you want to call it, and prior to those two games, you're talking about a 913 save percentage, which is very good in the context of the league right now. And meanwhile, the Boston goaltenders, who we were talking up, and I don't want to take too much away from them because clearly they're very good, but what they put on tape this year total is a 915. So again, it's not a massive gulf between the level Samsonov has been playing at for a few months. And, you know, it's a little unfair to take away those two games, but they really warp the stats. So we'll do it. And what Boston has been doing for most of the year. Would I say that I believe Samsonov is better than either of those goalies? No, but for the vast majority of you know, 2020, the calendar year of 2024, put it that way, he has played at a well above average clip. And he also, you know, we have some history. We have last season, we have last playoffs. We know that he's, you know, a first round pedigree guy, a talent guy, an athleticism guy. Like, it's not Martin Jones putting together some 20 game heater. You know what I mean? Like, there's underlying components to what makes Ilya Samsonov potentially good. And
he's, I guess, the way I would phrase it is, would I take Ullmark and Swayman over Samsonov? Like, if you said, you know, this summer, who would you want to have between those three goalies? Samsonov would be third, no questions asked.
For sure.
But is Ullmark Swayman a slam dunk better than Samsonov starting on Saturday? No. That's all. I don't think it's a slam dunk. I don't think the gap is as big as it's being portrayed. And I think that there's legitimate potential for it to actually look really good on the Leafs. And to everything we've said before, it's not like the Bruins are oozing shooting talent. There's three or four shooters. You know, Jake DeBrus turns into a superstar every year against the Leafs. Pasternak is good. Zacha has a bomb. Brad Marchand is Brad Marchand. Charlie Coyle's a good player.
I mean, everything basically you just said, you could apply to the whole series, right? Like, do I think that Boston is a slightly better team than the Maple Leafs? Do I think they're slightly more likely to win than the Maple Leafs in this series? I would say yes. But I also think that the gap is pretty damn small. And a lot of people are treating it like the gap is huge. And if someone wants to convince me that the Leafs are a better team, I'm open-minded to that argument. I don't think I'd quite go there, because at the end of the day, the results are kind of the results. And the defense core in particular, there's that really big gap there between what Boston has and what the Maple Leafs have. But
I actually do think the Leafs are a better team, straight up.
All right.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to hate myself for saying it, but I don't know. I look at their, I don't think if you pulled any general manager, I don't think you'd be like, which team do you want to run? I think 10 out of 10 pick the Leafs. I think 30 out of 30 or whatever. I mean, teams are in this league right now, 31. Like, I think they all pick the Leafs.
Well, already erasing the Coyotes.
Like, yeah, they erased themselves. I didn't erase anything, but I think as you go through it, you would just be like, superstar at center, two star wingers, all in their primes. You know, I think that there's nice support pieces. I think the Leafs have a really good cast of young players coming up as this like secondary group. Whether they're good this year, I don't know. Come playoff time, young players are always just a massive question mark come playoffs. Although I'm quietly optimistic about Swedish playoff champ Pontus Holmberg being a playoff guy. We'll see.
He's a winner.
You know? Yeah. Winners are winners, man. Hey, winning breeds winning. Like, there is something to be said about being like a serial winner. I think Tyler Bertuzzi is probably also in that category. We'll see. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I see it. Like, I see what like the Bruins have a net. I get that. I also don't think the Leafs are like devoid of talent in net. Like, I think Joseph Woll's an excellent young goalie. I think he needs to stay healthy and clean up his game right now, but he's a promising young goalie. Like, Samsonov's a young goalie. I do think the Leafs have a few things on defense. I don't think it's the black hole that it's obviously not Boston level good. I think a lot of people, if they looked at that, would say, all right, like, you have a Bruins team that generally speaking gets outplayed, and they rely on their goalie and some like counterpunch offense, or you have a Leafs team that's like legitimately one of the best offensive teams in the league. I think their goaltending has kind of smoothed things out. And by and large, like, they're not getting territorially outplayed. Like, the Leafs do not, there's very few games where you're like, the Leafs like actually get tilted, but there's almost every game the Bruins get actively outplayed.
I would agree with most of that, but that summary doesn't mention the special teams gap, which is a big factor for Boston.
Yeah. A lot of that's coaching too, though. Like, why don't the Leafs power play light them up? Like, they should. Like, the Leafs power play is excellent.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the roster and the results, you could make an inference about which team has been coached better over the course of the season. Now,
easily,
the Maple Leafs have had a lot of injuries. And anyway, we don't need to walk down that path. Before we get out of here today, I mean, I guess you've hinted at it, but what is the final prediction for the series from you?
Oh, hate it. Like, if it was Florida, I wouldn't feel as good about it. Although I do think Florida is a good matchup in terms of like, they'll trade chances with the Leafs, which I think plays to their advantage. Even though I know they're stout defensively, like, Florida will play very loose and fast with teams. So all that to say is Leafs in six.
I'm going to say Leafs in seven, because when I say seven, it's me admitting that I have no idea which team. Like, whenever you make a prediction in seven, it's just like, This is me telling you I don't have an idea, but I think it's extremely close.
A cowardly move. A cowardly move.
A very cowardly move. Leafs in seven. But I'll give it to Leafs. I just said that I think that Boston is the better team, but I also don't think that always matters. And the Leafs have had so much disproportionately bad luck in the playoffs. I'm just going to go with the old pendulum of regression here, say a few things bounce their way, and the Maple Leafs are going to be victorious in this one. We'll see what happens if we get to Florida. It might be a different prediction. We are going to leave it with you there. We will be back. We're not a particularly organized outfit, so I cannot at this particular second say precisely what our playoff cadence will look like, but we will try and be with you consistently throughout the playoff run, however long that takes. And we appreciate reviews, ratings, telling people about the podcast. No matter what happens, it's going to be an exciting time for a couple of weeks here. So as much as playoff hockey has brought Maple Leafs fans an enormous amount of hurt over the last few years, there is also the potential for some great times, and maybe that's what we'll see. So we will be with you again next week.
Down by three. Look inside yourself, what do you see? The pain is in your mind, no, nothing stops me. Everyone is looking at me. Heart is pounding and we're down by three. Look inside yourself, I know what I see. Do you have the guts to do